nice. We can read to each other, and I can break in my reading glasses if I need them. I hate them, but I may not be able to see. I generally don't know what I'm going to read, and that still holds true. But I usually like to start with a poem. I know that I want to read part of a children's book and part of a prose book and some new poems, and it won't take as long as that sounds. I like to start with my most universal poem, and that's because people think that a black woman poet cannot be universal. This is because a lot of people believe that there is such a thing as universal. These are the same people who believe in objectivity, I think. I have found this poem to be universal. It's called Homage to My Hips. Generally, I walk out so people can see that I do indeed have hips and know whereof I speak. But you can tell, I'm sure. You saw me walk up here. Homage to my hips. These hips are big hips. They need space to move around in. They don't fit into little, petty places. These hips are free hips. They don't like to be held back. These hips have never been enslaved. They go where they want to go. They do what they want to do. These hips are mighty hips. These hips are magic hips. I have known them to put a spell on a man and spin him like a top. I have another poem that's sort of universal like that. Now, I believe that poetry can be fun. That doesn't mean that it's not true or not serious. I always say I think that Richard Pryor's proved that a lot of very serious stuff is pretty funny. And so I like to have fun with poetry. I also write about body parts a lot. I have been told that that's trivial of me and female to do that. But I am convinced that the reason men don't write about body parts is that they don't have that many interesting body parts. Whereas I have scores of interesting body parts. Now, this poem happened for two reasons. One was, my late husband used to teach at Harvard, and I was very impressed with that. I was impressed because my father said he would not amount to anything, and he, in fact, taught at Harvard. And I used to go visit him. He commuted from Baltimore, which is where I lived for many years, and I would go up there and stand to be impressed. You know, I would stand in Harvard Square, and one day, standing there, I looked around, and all the females were girls, you know, and I am a woman, not a girl. And it was depressing for a few minutes. And then I thought about in the media in this country, if you look in magazines and look at television and everything, all the females are girls. Everybody's like 18. I haven't been 18 in over 18 years. And generally they're all thin, actually, and many of them have long hair. It's quite something. So that was one germ for this poem. Another was a day when I got up and I looked in the mirror, and the mirror said, don't go out like that, girl. You know, the world has not done anything to you. But I had to go out anyway. And so this is a poem on a day when I wanted the mirror to say something encouraging to me. And in fact, it did. This is called What the Mirror Said. Listen, you a wonder. You a city of a woman. You got a geography of your own. Listen, somebody need a map to understand you. Somebody need directions to move around you. Listen, woman, you not a no place anonymous girl. A mister with his hands on you. He got his hands on some damn body. And well, that's true, of course. I'll just read body parts. Why not? This is called Homage to My Hair. There was a time, you won't believe this, there was a time when I thought I had bad hair. Why did I think my hair was bad? What was it doing? You know, was it disobeying? Was it drinking too much? I can't imagine. Why did I think my hair was bad? But I used to think that. It was, however, many years ago, because I've worn my hair nappy, a word one never said, for about 25 years. And it was a little more interesting during the earlier years because people would not, and I wear pants all the time. No political reasons, I'm comfortable in them. People knock on the door and I answer and they say, is your wife at home? And it's kind of embarrassing. But anyway, I wanted to write something about my wonderful hair, which I adore, and this is called Homage to My Hair. When I feel her jump up and dance, I hear the music. My God, I'm talking about my nappy hair. She is a challenge to your hand, black man. She is as tasty on your tongue as good greens, black man. She can touch your mind with her electric fingers. And the grayer she do get, good God, the blacker she do be. Now, I must tell you, actually, I have six kids. I have four daughters and two sons, all adults. And for my daughters, I'm sort of a big Cabbage Patch doll. I really am. They experiment with me. So in terms of my hair, the only real color is the white, you know, because actually my hair's been all white for many years. But they wanted to play with me one day, and so they did that. I think I'd like to read a couple of new body parts, and then some prose. This is a poem. As I say, I have four daughters and two sons. And I get very annoyed with my sons. I get annoyed with my daughters, too, but my sons really can bug me. And I was talking to my oldest daughter about it, and my oldest daughter also has two sons. I have two grandsons. And my oldest daughter explained to me what there is about men, and there are men here, and I want to share this because I am a kind and just woman. My oldest daughter told me about it, and so this is called Wishes for Sons. I wish them cramps. I wish them a strange town and the last tampon. I wish them no 7-Eleven. I wish them 1 week early and wearing a white skirt. I wish them 1 week late. Later, I wish them hot flashes and clots like you wouldn't believe. Let the flashes come when they meet somebody special. Let the clots come when they want to. Let them learn order and place in the universe. Then let them try to find gynecologists not unlike themselves. Now, I know that means nothing to you, but it pleasured me at the time. I write books for children, and I'd like to read a little part of one now. I read for children generally when my voice is tired, because children's books don't take as much out of me, I guess. And this is a book which is called The Lucky Stone, and this is based sort of on stories that my father used to tell me. I listened to my father when he talked, which I did not always do. And this is based pretty much on stories that my father used to tell me about his family, our family. And this is the first part of a book called The Lucky Stone. And it's about a stone that is passed down to several generations of black women in the family. In the story, the heroine is a little girl who's called T. Her great-grandmother calls her Sweet T. And her great-grandmother is telling her a story. That smile you got remind me of a lady, her great-grandmother began. Remind me of a lady long, long, long time ago. Now, this lady was named Vashti, and she lived with her mama right down the road from me and mine. Her and her mama used to sit out in the summertime on their front porch, just rocking like this and smiling just like you, so pretty and polite. But we was all scared of them, because they had real long fingernails on their fingers and real long toenails on their toes. They never did say nothing to us or one another till one day me and my friends was passing by them soft-like, and they was smiling and rocking on their porch, and the one Vashti leaned across the railing and whispered right to me, girl, you bring me a glass of cool water, I'll give you a lucky stone. Now, you know that scared me half to death, but it wondered me, too. And dog, if I didn't light out and run back home and fetch back to that porch a long drink of cool water. Yes, and I can still hear them long fingernails slicking on the glass while she drank it all down her long throat. Then she made me come close to her, and she reached in her bosom and handed me a warm stone, shiny black as nighttime, except for a scratch looked just like a letter A. And she said the stone was mine. I tell you, sweet tea, I was saying my prayers. I was so scared, but I didn't let on. Thank you, ma'am, but that's all right, I said to her. But she come right close with her face to the porch rail. Take it. I got no other chick nor child. It's a lucky stone, she said. So I took it and kept it, and I got it still. And one fine day, I'm going to give it to you, sweet tea. And the story of that stone is this. When Vashti's mama, Miss Mandy, was a little girl, it was slavery time. One day when she was working in the hot sun picking cotton, a mean old snake come creeping up on her by her foot, and she gave a holler and fell down and dumped the sack she was carrying. It split wide open, and all the cotton was ruined, don't you know, a whole load of cotton. Now, she was just a girl, but she was scared because she was due for a beating indeed, and she didn't want to be whipped by that mean old boss man. She had never been whipped before, and she had promised herself she never would be. So she just started creeping, easy and fast and low down in the field so nobody could see her. But the boss man saw her anyhow and started toward her on his horse with the whip in his hand, and she lit out so scared and ran off from the field and hid in a cave. Come dark, she was too scared to go back. And come day again, she was too scared because she had been gone all night. One day become two, and 2 days become three, and on the third day she heard dogs far off and knew she couldn't go back or move from where she was, that little girl. Well, didn't nobody know where she was, slave nor free. When one evening after near a week had gone by, an old driver from the plantation was riding by that cave bringing the carriage when a stone shot out and spooked his horse. That horse reared up, but the driver held him and got him stopped and steady, and then he got down to see what it was that hit his horse, and he found on the ground a stone, black as night. Well, that old man was disgusted that one little stone was making him lose time like that, so he picked it up and threw it back into the cave. And, T, do you know that while he was walking back to the carriage, that stone comes sailing out of the cave again and hit him on the neck? That old driver grabbed it up where it fell and looked at it and knew it for the same stone, black as night, but this time it had the letter A scratched on one side. Now, Miss Mandy's right name was Amanda, you know, and her old miss had showed her the letters of it one time. So, of course, now everybody's slave knew where the child was hid. After that, every week, regular, some slave would walk or ride by the way of that cave and lose something there. Sometime a chicken, and sometimes some fruit, and sometimes some potatoes and homemade bread. Every natural week until emancipation. Weeks and months, T, baby, more than a year. After emancipation, the girl came out from that cave with wild hair and eyes and with them long fingernails on her fingers and them long toenails on her toes, and she had that stone with her, and she gave it to her daughter, Vashti, when she got one, and like I have told you, Vashti give it to me. And then they go on. I live in Santa Cruz. Now, Santa Cruz is a wonderful place, but it is not known as a hotbed of a black community. And sometime if you come from, like, Baltimore, you know, and I was born in Buffalo, and I've lived on the East Coast in urban centers all my life, sometime you can look around and say, wait a minute, where the black folks? So I wrote a poem, which is to Santa Cruz. The poem is written to Santa Cruz. It is called Life in Santa Cruz, or Homage to the Tops. And all the lines are lines from songs sung by the Four Tops, lines or titles from the Four Tops. And you know that the lead singer of the Four Tops is Levi Stubbs, right? So this is to Santa Cruz. Life in Santa Cruz, or Homage to the Tops. Sugar Pie Honey Bunch, don't you know I love you? But I can't help myself, like the Four Tops say. I'm in a different world. This is a different world, Levi, and maybe I'll turn to stone. So many faces are not my faces. So many songs are not my songs. I know it's all in the game, Levi, but sometimes these rooms are rooms of gloom. And Sugar Pie Honey Bunch, you know that I love you, but it can be so lonely, just like the Four Tops say. I did some poems about a subject that has only recently not been taboo, a poem that subject that women write about. I call them the shapeshifter poems. Do you know what a shapeshifter is? A shapeshifter is a word for a creature that for some reason, can change, or without even wishing to, changes shape. A werewolf is a shapeshifter. So this is a creature that can suddenly become something other than what is familiar. And perhaps you will understand what the poems are about, the shapeshifter poems. One, the legend is whispered in the women's tent. How the moon, when she rises full, follows some men into themselves and changes them there. The season is short, but dreadful. Shapeshifters, they wear strange hands. They walk through the houses at night. Their daughters do not know them. Two. Who is there to protect her from the hands of the father? Not the windows which see and say nothing, not the moon, that awful eye, not the woman she will become with her scarred tongue. Who, the owl laments into the evening, who will protect her, this pretty little girl? Three. If the little girl lies still enough, shut enough, hard enough, shapeshifter may not walk tonight. The full moon may not find him here, the hair on him bristling, rising up. Four. The poem at the end of the world is the poem the little girl breathes into her pillow. The one she cannot tell, the one there is no one to hear. This poem is a political poem, is a war poem, is a universal poem, but is not about these things. This poem is about one human heart. This poem is the poem at the end of the world. I'm very fond of the Pacific. The Pacific is a nice ocean. You all have a nice ocean. It's great. I was trying to explain that to a colleague at UCSC, and some of our faculty are from New England, which I also am very fond of New England, and they were trying to tell me that the Atlantic is the heavy ocean. That's the ocean. And I wanted to say, it is very difficult for a person of my complexion to be fond of the Atlantic. But it's hard to say, you know. And also, I am aware of the fact that people of an Asian complexion may not be that fond of the Pacific. But anyway, I wanted to write something about. So this is a poem about the Pacific, but the Pacific is not mentioned. It's really a poem about the Atlantic. You know what Middle Passage was? The route that the slave ships took. And oddly enough, a lot of those people didn't want to be slaves. And so some of them jumped overboard, and many of the mothers threw children overboard, and they were not happy. And the poem begins with a song which is often sung in the Baptist church. I am ex-Baptist. I read a lot. I have crossed the country that is full of ex-Baptists. The country is... Are you going to see? Do I kid you with this face lie? The country is full of ex-Baptists, but there are not a lot of Baptists. And lately, I think there are less, don't you? I mean, but anyway. Them bones will rise again. Them bones will walk again. Them bones will talk again. Now, hear the word of the Lord. Atlantic is a sea of bones, my bones, my elegant Africans connecting Wida and New York, a bridge of ivory. Seabed, they call it. In its arms, my early mothers sleep. Some women leapt with babies in their arms. Some women wept and threw the babies in. Maternal armies pace the Atlantic floor. I call my name into the roar of surf, and something awful answers. As I say, I read a lot, and I can tell when I'm tired of reading because I start noticing things. I was Poet Laureate of Maryland for 8 years until I came here. I resigned because I didn't see why the Poet Laureate of Maryland should live in California. Though, do you know who the Poet Laureate of New Hampshire is? Robert Frost. And we called, a friend of mine and I called wherever you call for this information, and asked, and they said it was Robert Frost. We didn't have the heart to say he's dead. You know, we just thought, oh, that's great. So maybe I could have stayed Poet Laureate of Maryland. I don't know. But anyway, when I was Poet Laureate of Maryland, I never wrote a poem. I felt that I should not write official poems, and I told them, I'm not going to write it. I don't do windows. I don't come in the back door. I don't write official poems. And I did ask the governor if he'd ever read anything I wrote, and he said, why, no. And I thought, this is going to be a good relationship. This is going to work. But I did feel, on the 350th anniversary of Maryland, I did feel that perhaps I should write a poem. This sounds like a good time. And so I tried to. But it was difficult because the theme of Maryland's 350th anniversary was our happy colonial days. Well, I didn't have more than two happy colonial days, you know, maybe a couple. So it was very hard for me to do. So I wrote a poem for them, and I wrote another little poem for Lucille. And this is apropos of this. The other little poem was, they asked me to remember, but they want me to remember their memories, and I keep on remembering mine. And this is sort of a thing. When you read a lot, you go to a lot of places, and oddly enough, I am not asked by Black Studies departments that much. I'm usually asked by English departments or Women's Studies. And I go to most places, I am the only dark face there. And periodically, I notice that, you know. So this is a poem. Somebody said, you are biting the hand that feeds you. And I tried to explain that actually UCSC lets me work hard, that I feed me. This is a poem at the end of a tour in northern New York State when I was tired, and so I noticed everything, okay? It's called In White America, and it's also in a lot of parts. Somebody told me I write poems in parts, and I never noticed until they told me that. It's the truth. One of the things I noticed in this tour, this is a sort of a composite of a lot of places in this tour. One of the things I noticed is there's always somebody there that thinks I'm wonderful, but they don't think I'm wonderful because I write good poetry. They think I'm wonderful because I can write cursive, you know? And I always think, you know, I mean, they're always just so amazed that I stand on two legs and I walk and everything. I've heard of, like, somebody, it's kind of exciting. Anyway, In White America, one. I come to read them poems. A fancy trick I do, like juggling with balls of light. I stand a dark spinner in the Grange Hall, in the library, in the smaller conference room, and toss and catch as if by magic, my eyes bright, my mouth smiling, my singed hands burning. Two, the history. And when I go places, I always ask to find out about the place. I have a pack rat mind, I'm very nosy. And I want to know the history, what happened here, and where are the people, and who are the people, etc. Well, in this town, during the early years, the Cayuga Indian people lived there. And there were about 150 warriors in that nation. And somewhere in the capital, the militia heard about them. And so they wanted to march on and destroy them. And so thousands of militia were trying to march on these 150 Cayuga warriors who were not crazy. So they left. So when the militia got there, they didn't see any people to destroy, so they just destroyed everything else. Anyway, the history. 1800s in this town, 14 longhouses were destroyed by not these people here. Not these people burned the crops and chopped down all the peach trees. Not these people. These people preserve peaches. Even now. Three, the tour. This reading was going to take place in a church, but they wanted to show me how progressive, etc., the town was. And in fact, it is. It's a beautiful town, and don't misunderstand me, I loved it. This is a quote, though. They were showing me how progressive they are. And they had educated females long before anybody else. So, three, the tour. This was a female school. My mother's mother graduated second in her class. They were taught embroidery and chenille and filigree. Ladies learning. Yes, we have a liberal history here. Smiling, she pats my darky hand. 4, the hall. This reading took place in a church, and it was a church that, like many churches, if you look around your church, you don't see a lot of dark faces, that black people at one time could not worship. The hall. In this hall, dark women scrubbed the aisles between the pews on their knees. They could not rise to worship. In this hall, dark women, my sisters and mothers, though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not charity, in this hall, dark women, my sisters and mothers, I stand and let the church say, let the church say, let the church say, amen. 5, the reading. I look into none of my faces and do the best I can. The human hair between us stretches but does not break. I slide myself along it and love them all. 6. It is late in white America. I stand in the light of the 7-Eleven looking out toward the church, and for a moment only, I feel the reverberation of myself in white America, a black cat in the belfry, hanging and ringing. When I was young, my father, when he was in his cups, and he was in them periodically, but this is not racial, there are a lot of cups, you know. Used to say to me, Lucille, you are not the first Lucille. And he would go on to say, well, I knew that, right? But he would go on to say, the first Lucille was the first black woman legally hanged in the state of Virginia. And I used to think about that a lot. I really did. He used to say a lot of things to me. My father was a magnificent man. He used to tell me that I could get it. He always used to say, do what you want, you from Dahomey women. And he also used to say, everywhere you are, you're there because you're supposed to be there, or you wouldn't be there, which I believed. Sometimes to my detriment, actually. He would talk about that one who came over, who was born among the Dahomey people in 1823, captured in 1830, and brought to New Orleans, and walked from in a slave coffle from New Orleans to Virginia, sold to a man named Bob Donald. So she was called Caroline, or Bob Donald's Caroline, or Caroline Donald. I say called because, you have to trust me on this one, very few people at that time on the African continent were named Caroline. Very few. Caroline was sold to Bob Donald. She was trained as a midwife, and she also worked in an orchard. There was also a slave who was called Uncle Sam Lewis. He wasn't anybody's uncle. And he had been a Christmas present to the early family. Now, I always think he was a Christmas present. Okay, where do you put the tag? You know what I mean? Where does the bow go? This is very interesting. How do you do that? Anyway, he was a slave too old to work at this time. Now, we have to trust me on this, too. He must have been old, because they did not let you retire when you were slaves. There was no Social Security, no pensions, nothing. And because he was a slave too old to work, but they couldn't just let him rot, so they had him driving the carriage. He drove a carriage for his master, who was blind. And he was driving by an orchard, and he saw Caroline in the orchard, and he asked that she be bought for him for his wife. Now, you say, the man was too old to work. What was he going to do with a wife, right? Well, they had 7 children, which always reminds me of my father used to say, oh, slavery was terrible, baby, but we come out of it better than they did. Their oldest child was named Lucille, called Lucy. And after the Civil War, the war between the states, it is alleged, and now I have to say alleged, because if you notice, history, white people's history in this country, always happened. Black people's history is alleged to have happened. Do you ever notice that? Allegedly, all kind of things went on, but probably not really, right? It is alleged that a man named Harvey Nichols came from Connecticut with his family to Virginia to make money. He was a carpetbagger after the war. It is alleged that he saw Lucy, and it is alleged that she had a child by Harvey Nichols, a son. Now, after that, I can go back to what I know, because Harvey Nichols' son, Jeannie, was my grandfather. When the baby was less than a year old, Lucy killed Harvey Nichols. And so I have to tell you this. I say that, and then this little section of this book is written in my father's voice. So this is my daddy talking. And the latter part of it is in my own voice as a girl. And the thing to remember all the stereotypes that you never pay attention to and don't listen to and don't believe for 1 minute. Try to think back to them. And remember that Harvey Nichols, a white man from Connecticut, was my great-great-grandfather. Okay. Yes, Lord, he was born with a withered arm. And when he was still just a baby, Lucy waited by the crossroad one night for Harvey Nichols to come to her. And when he rode up on a white horse, she cocked up a rifle she had stole and shot him off his horse and killed him, Lou. And she didn't run away. She didn't run away. She waited right there by the body with the rifle in her hand till the horse, coming back empty saddle to the stable, brought a mob to see what had become of Harvey Nichols. And when they got to the crossroad, they found Lucy standing there with a rifle in her hand. And they didn't lynch her, Lou, because she was Mammy Caroline's child and from Dahomey women. That's what I believe. Mammy Caroline got one of the lawyer Sale family to defend her daughter, because they was all lawyers and preachers in that family. They had a legal trial, and Lucy was found guilty and hanged. Mammy Caroline took the baby boy, Jeannie, and raised him and never let him forget who he was. I used to ask her sometime, Mammy, was you scared back then about Grandma Lucy? And she would look right at me and say, I'm scared for you, mister, that's all. She always called me mister. She said I was Mr. Sale. And Lou, I always was. Later, I would ask my father for proof. Where are the records, Daddy? I would ask. The time may not be right. It might just be a family legend or something. Somebody somewhere knows, he would say. And I would be dissatisfied and fuss with Fred about fact and proof and history until he told me one day not to worry, that even the lies are true. In history, even the lies are true. And there would be days when we young Sales would be trying to dance and sing in the house, and Sammy, my brother, would miss a step and not be able to keep up to the music, and neither one of us could ever learn how to dance. Sammy would look over in the corner of the room and holler, "Damn, Harvey Nichols," and we would laugh. We always blamed him for our lack of rhythm in my family. I'd like to end with a poem, which is also in parts, called California Lessons. I've learned some things since I've been in California, things I didn't know, which is always joyous. I should tell you that, I know you know all this, but I'm just saying it so I can remind myself, that Siddhartha Gautama is the name given to the Buddha. Gautama was a rich man's son, and he was protected from the evils of the world. And when he became a man, he decided to go out from his home and see the world, and he was astounded by the extremes that he found. And he went, and that led to him sitting under a Bodhi tree and becoming the Buddha, which means enlightened. The Miwok, the Pomo, the Shasta, and the Esalen are the names of indigenous Native American peoples who have lived in California. Internment, you know what internment is about? And I'm playing on the idea that an intern, of course, is a medical healer. Anyway, and karma is something in which I believe, which I know to be true. There's some things I believe, some stuff I know, and karma is one of the ones I know. And that means that what my dad used to say, everything that goes around comes around. And also, all goodbye ain't gone. California Lessons. 1, geography. Over there is Asia, watching from the water, astounded as Siddhartha. Over there, Asia, waiting in the water for what is surely turning on the wheel. Here is California, swinging from the edge of the darkening of America, and over there, sitting, patient as Gautama enlightened in the water is Asia. 2, history. Guard your language. What bird remembers the songs the Miwok sang? Guard your life. Pomo, Shasta, Esalen, peoples, not places. 3, botany. Quote, all common figs can produce fertile seeds if the flowers are pollinated, end quote. In Concord, in 1985, a black man was hung from a fig tree. Quote, the fruit is dark and sweet, end quote. 4, semantics. In 1942, almost all the Japanese were concentrated into camps. Internment, but no doctor came. 5, metaphysics. Question, what is karma? Answer, there is a wheel, and it is turning. Thank you very much.